this series. If you have the brochure, there is a notice with respect to the last of the lectures to the effect that it is to be announced. You might also, if you wish, pick up a little form which is available on the desk outside in the rotunda, which will inform you that the speaker at the last lecture in the series will be Jessica Mitford of Oakland, California, who will speak on inside muckraking. Perhaps I could, just for a moment, review with you some of the things that have happened this series so far, since we're at the midpoint, so to speak. We have had a lecture on hormones and the brain, on faith, capitalism, and technology. We've heard that small is profitable from the president of the University of Prince Edward Island. Last week, genetic engineering. We have next week another lecture in a subject which is somewhat related to the one about which we will hear this evening, nuclear weapons next week. Then we'll hear about the future of broadcasting in Canada, a delightful one, I think, on the Scottish Enlightenment, David Hume, the origin of the universe. So there's a great deal of variety. I would ask you to consider taking out membership in the Vancouver Institute and supporting us in what we think is an interesting, exciting series on Saturday evenings in Vancouver. Tonight, there's something of an experiment in the sense that we have invited Dr. Singer to come back to us after being here just a year ago. We did that because he is considered as the world's leading authority on the causes of major international war. Last March, he spoke to us about international security in the 1980s. Tonight, he will speak on military strategy, political tactics, and survival. He is a citizen of the United States of America. He was born in Brooklyn. He obtained his PhD at New York University in 1956 and lectured at various universities from 1960 to the present time. He has been the senior scientist at the University of Michigan, the Mental Health Research Institute. From 1963 and 64, he was at the University of Oslo and the Institute for Social Research. From 1965 to the present, he has been a professor of political science at the University of Michigan. 1967-68, the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and Graduate Institute of International Studies, Geneva. 1969 to 1975, he was the coordinator of World Politics Program at the University of Michigan. He was a member of the United States Naval Reserve from 1945 to 1966 and was on active duty in both the Second World War and the Korean War. He has numerous honors and has received numerous grants. He is on a number of editorial boards, including the Journal of Conflict Resolution and a couple on political science. He is responsible for a great number of publications. There's something which I'm sure most of you probably have heard, of which you have heard in the last day or so, and it has to do with our National Film Board. I asked Dr. Singer if, I said, do you love this planet? And he said, yes, that's why I'm here. I don't know whether his speech tonight will get him an Oscar, but I present him to you.
Well, thank you very much, Judge Traynor, Chancellor Klein. I'm delighted to be invited back. Many academics get invited to speak to a general public audience once, and they are seldom heard from again. I can assume from this that I either scared you enough to suggest that this is worth discussing further, or you found it particularly amusing and perhaps worth an Oscar. It seems to me rather prophetic that you will soon be hearing from somebody among whose most famous works is The American Way of Death. Tonight I'll be talking about the Soviet and American and Canadian way of death. Now, in talking about military strategy and survival, we need to address a relatively wide range of questions. And one of the things that's encouraging about the current upsurge in the peace movement in the Western world is that more than in any of the earlier upsurges, people are willing to do the homework and willing to talk about this range of phenomena. Now, what I allude to, of course, is the fundamental law that says, in order to do away with war, we must understand war. For too long, the peace-oriented people of the world have essentially worked on the assumption that if you care enough and you make a moral protest, and you demonstrate a genuine concern, somehow or other the moral reform will occur, the spiritual enlightenment will take place, and the nations will beat their swords into plowshares. By now we should know that that is indeed an idle dream. We are today in a very, very precarious state of affairs. If we're going to break out of the state of affairs, it will take a very large, articulate, well-informed, and energetic peace movement, a large sector of the electorate and the citizenry in many countries of the world. And what I hope to do tonight is give you at least one man's perspective on what the problems are, why the situation is these days even more dangerous than it was when I spoke to you 11 months ago, and what some of the things are that might be done to slightly improve the odds on human survival. Now, in order to do this, I need to make two points perfectly clear. One is that the nuclear war problem is not going to go away by giving more attention to other international or domestic problems. And those of you who've been involved in the peace movement for a good many years can appreciate how, particularly beginning in the middle 60s and extending well into the late 70s, a great many people assumed that the nuclear war problem would go away if we could only solve such minor problems as worldwide human dignity, poverty, education, literacy, and malnutrition. And needless to say, those problems have not gone away. Those problems have not been solved. And in the meantime, of course, we have gone further down the slippery slope. The other point that needs to be made is that we do not yet know enough about the dynamics of war and the conditions of peace. I have spent the best part of my research time during the last 16 years trying to get a handle on the causes of war. I think that the group around the Correlates of War Project is closer than any other research group or individual in beginning to understand the dynamics that lead nations from normal relationships into mild disputes, to moderate disputes, to serious disputes, to dangerous confrontations, and over the escalatory brink into war. We think we're beginning to get a handle on it. But I must emphasize, first, a lot of what I have to say is based not on hard research evidence, but only on intuitive and anecdotal evidence and on crude analogy. And then secondly, anything that you can do at the University of British Columbia to increase the resources that are allocated to research on the causes of war and conditions of peace would indeed be doing the Lord's work. Now, having said these introductory things, let me try to summarize some of the factors that are, let's call them, critical ingredients in the calculus that can lead to at least a reasonable level of national security, and for the moment, let's concentrate on the North American societies of Canada and the USA. Now, one of the things you need, of course, is some degree of moral integration in the society. A society that is deeply divided is typically a society that is extremely vulnerable to destruction from without and from within. Another condition, of course, is some degree of economic security for a large fraction of the population. Another thing that is really quite essential is the belief that social justice, particularly in the sense of distributive justice, is either close to being achieved or that we are at least on the way to achieving social justice. Another thing the society needs for some modicum of security in this anarchistic international system of ours is the right kind of military capabilities and a reputation of credibility such that the threats and the promises that are made have a reasonably high chance of being believed. Now, I put it this way in order to emphasize that military capabilities by themselves are not enough, that the military capabilities must be in tandem with economic solidarity, a decent degree of social integration, a high level of social justice, and a military and foreign policy doctrine that is consonant with and supportive of the kind of military strategy and military capabilities that a nation acquires. Now, in building military capacity, almost all sovereign states start with some kind of intuitive notion as to what is the appropriate level. There are and have been very few sovereign states in the history of the modern interstate system that have not had some kind of armed force. As a matter of fact, in today's world, the only two nations that do not have bona fide armed forces are both in the Western Hemisphere, Iceland and Costa Rica, outside of a few of the more what should be referred to as postage stamp states. A military force, a military establishment, is as essential to a sovereign state in today's world as a gentleman's necktie. It is part of the symbolism, if you will, of national sovereignty and represents notions as to how we shall protect ourselves from foreign adversaries. Now, for a multiplicity of reasons, nations very frequently build their military capabilities well above the normal low level. And I need merely tick these off to remind you that nations do not acquire and deploy weaponry only for national security purposes. Military establishments are built up in order to hasten economic development, or to hasten economic recovery, or to take up the slack in unemployment, or to bring delinquents in off the streets. Military capabilities are built up because they are good for certain sectors of a society. Military contracts are always advantageous for some regions, some districts, some strata, some sectors of every society, no matter how detrimental they may be economically for other sectors and regions and strata of the society. Nations also begin to overbuild military capabilities in response to certain kind of folklore about the menacing nature of a real or imagined rival. And if certain ideological premises become widely accepted and increasingly unquestioned, as they have particularly in the USSR and the United States of America, then it's increasingly easy for those who will benefit psychologically, politically, economically from yet another buildup in military capabilities. If the public has been gulled, if the public has been sold a bill of goods, if the media have done their usual incompetent job of illuminating and clarifying, it's quite an easy matter. And today in the USSR and the United States of America, we find two societies that in many ways are in the grip of and victims of a stranglehold grip of a complex that includes not just the military and the industrial. If it were just the military-industrial, it would be a lot easier for informed, outraged, humanely oriented citizens to turn the bloody thing around. The conspiracy, if you will, is much too wide and much too deep. The universities are deeply involved. Most of organized labor, again, I'm talking about North America and the Soviet Union, most of organized labor is an accomplice of continuing an excessive military buildup. A great many professions, particularly the engineering science professions, it's worse than that. All kinds of social science professions find it advantageous. There is a tremendous amount of research money, all kinds of conference and grant support for social scientists who are willing to play the game. And needless to say, those people who are in radio, television, cinema, magazines, and newspaper are usually the first to be brought into the conspiracy. Because without the media, and again, I want to emphasize the symmetry between the Soviet problem and the American problem. Without the media, it is virtually impossible to sell people a bill of goods. No matter how inadequate has been our education, no matter how distorted have been the history books from which we have learned, no matter how chauvinistic and jingoistic our political and cultural leaders have been, the media have to help to sell us a bill of goods. Okay, I've tried to indicate then that when somebody says we have built up a level of military capabilities sufficient to deter a potential rival and sufficient to defeat that potential rival if the deterrent fails, I would urge you to say that is hokum. There are lots of other factors, and the fact of the matter is that in 1983, the Soviets and the Americans are grievously overarmed. There have been a good many studies showing that the weapons acquisition process, especially in the U.S., is a highly politicized process that has very little to do with what we have come to understand as rational collective problem solving. It is a much more politicized, psychologized process in which cerebral, rational maximization or optimization strategies are virtually useless. We do not build these weapons merely because we need them. I would now like to suggest that not only are we overarmed on the Soviet side and the American side, and not only have the allies of the USSR, but the allies of the United States been supine, passive, acquiescent, and manifesting a tragic sense of inefficacy in trying to prevent the superpowers from getting further and further to closer to the brink of war without making any serious effort to head this process off. Now, if you look at military capabilities today, you're dealing with three basic classes of weaponry: strategic nuclear weapons, tactical nuclear weapons, and conventional weapons. Now, I'm leaving out a great many categories, but these are the three to which I would like to attend primarily. Now, on the Soviet side and on the American side, I think it is quite fair to say there is approximate parity in conventional capabilities. If you look at the global distribution of conventional Army, Navy, and Air Force, the Warsaw Pact and the NATO Pact forces are rather equally balanced. In Central Europe, the Warsaw Pact forces enjoy a slight superiority in some weapon systems and a slight inferiority in others. Let me say, lest there be any ambiguity, I think that the NATO forces are more than adequate to deter a conventional military attack against Western Europe from Eastern Europe. As a matter of fact, I want at the same time to emphasize that the capability of the NATO forces is not in and of itself the main reason that the Soviet bloc has not launched a conventional attack in Central Europe. Just consider the possibility the Soviets have never had any interest in launching a conventional attack against Central Europe. And there's nothing like having a fantastic deterrent designed to deter a behavioral pattern behind which there is almost no motivation. Now, I don't want to deny the fact that the Soviet Union plays a fairly typical number two major power role. The Soviet Union has clearly been an adventurous and opportunistically expansionist power. I would interpret this not as some effort to achieve global domination. As far as I'm concerned, no powerful figures in the Soviet Union, even during the Stalin period, had any serious interest in global domination in any strategic military sense of the word. Their interest in global domination was about as strong as American or, let's say, in earlier periods, French or British. Major powers typically try to maximize their sphere of influence. They try to minimize the capacity of other major powers to intervene and to, in any way, inhibit their autonomy and their sovereignty domestically and externally in that sphere of influence. There is no possible way in the technology of the last century, the technology of today, and in my view, the technology of the decades ahead, that any territorial state would be able to stand astride the global system. On the other hand, there is plenty of evidence to believe that any one of a number of powers could destroy today's international system. But as psychologists have known for a long time, there is a profound difference between what they call fate control, an ability to destroy, and behavior control, an ability to dominate and influence. Now, today, in the tactical nuclear field, again, you have what is I would consider to be approximate parity. In the Central European theater, the idea is that if the Warsaw Pact were to initiate any kind of military adventure and the NATO forces were incapable of responding effectively at the conventional level, they would escalate to tactical nuclears. As a matter of fact, we can thank the great American statesman Henry Kissinger for this really brilliant solution to finding a way to blur the gap between conventional and strategic weapons. Kissinger published a book in 1957 called Nuclear Weapons and Foreign Policy that I would have to characterize as one of the most foolish pieces of writing on international politics I've ever read, and the kind of thing that would never get a PhD even at the University of Michigan. In the strategic weapons field, and this is what I want to talk about primarily, there is an approximate parity between the East and the West, and if it mattered, you ought to know that the Soviets are pretty far behind. My point being, of course, that the Americans enjoy about a 9-7 superiority in deliverable nuclear warheads. The Americans enjoy, and this is particularly critical, an overwhelming superiority in terms of survivable deliverable nuclear warheads. As most of you probably appreciate, about 70% of the Soviet 7,200 or so strategic nuclear warheads are on land-based ICBMs, or land-based medium-range or intermediate-range ballistic missiles. Only about 30% of the Americans' 9,400 or so strategic warheads are in land-based systems, and the great bulk are either airborne or seaborne, particularly the submarine forces. So in terms of the one dimension that really matters, I won't get into great detail on throw weight, effective yield, CEP, and all these other things. On the other hand, I urge all of you to do your homework on these things so that when your fellow citizen says, you don't understand, the Russians are ahead in throw weight, you should be able to tell them exactly how trivial throw weight is in the strategic balance. Or they tell you, the Russians have more delivery vehicles, which is true. Tell them how unimportant that is. Make sure you've done your homework so that they can't snow you. And then when somebody says to you, Mister, if you knew what I know, you wouldn't be supporting the nuclear freeze. What you should say is, Mister, I know what you know, and apparently I know a lot more than you, and that's why I do support the nuclear freeze. I think that when I was here last year, I introduced a somewhat immodest concept known as the Singer Curve. Now, the only reason I give a name to it is that an economist colleague of ours down in the States by the name of Art Laffer has gotten a great degree of notoriety and popularity and several salary increases by introducing the concept of the Laffer Curve. The Laffer Curve represents a very reasonable hypothesis. He says, and I think quite rightly, that if a nation has a very low tax rate, by raising that tax rate, it will raise overall tax revenues. And as you continue to raise the tax rate, you continue to increase total revenues available to the provincial or federal government. But as Laffer reminds us, at a certain point, you begin to have a tax rate that begins to look confiscatory, or it begins to inhibit and deter productivity or the search for jobs or successful investment or what have you. And pretty soon, the federal revenues, after having reached an upper peak, begin to decline as the tax rate increases. The Singer Curve says exactly the same thing about military preparedness. When you increase military preparedness from a very low level, you tend to increase the nation's security in an internationally anarchistic environment in which there are a number of states run by political elites who have moderately to extremely expansionistic or revisionist foreign policies. The question, of course, is how far do you go before you have gotten to this asymptote, this point on the curve at which increases in military capability are producing decreases in national security. In my view, the Russians and the Americans reached that point about 20 years ago. Both sides now suffer, and the world therefore suffers, from what we will call a provocation to deterrence ratio that is well above one. In other words, every weapon system has some kind of provocative characteristics, and every weapon system has some kind of deterrent characteristics. And what we need to go to today, in order to find our way back to a more sane and humane global system, is an elimination and an eradication of those weapons that have a high provocative characteristic and a low deterrent characteristic. What are some of those weapon systems? The first, of course, is the American MX. The MX is a weapon system that, if deployed, will be more accurate and more destructive than any other land-based system the Americans have deployed so far, and markedly more accurate than any that the Soviets have deployed so far. Now, you might say, well, gee, accuracy is a good thing. Accuracy, ladies and gentlemen, is a very bad thing. The reason accuracy is a bad thing is that it permits your weapons to threaten the survival of the other fellow's retaliatory weapons. And the one thing you don't want to do is lead the decision makers on the other side to believe that you might, because you have the material capacity, and because you clearly have malignant intentions anyway, that goes without saying, to lead the adversary to believe that under propitious circumstances, you might use these highly accurate weapons in an effort to wipe out his land-based and also highly accurate weapons. Now, the problem is compounded if your weapon, and I'm talking now about the MX particularly, we'll get to some of the others in a moment, the problem is compounded if these highly accurate weapons are also highly vulnerable. And there is nothing more vulnerable than a land-based ICBM. Now, as you probably know, the Americans came up with 37 different basing mode options for this MX, which is another way of saying there was one hell of an incentive to produce and deploy this weapon, and they were willing to consider the most harebrained, dinky-doo systems that the human mind could conceive of to make sure that these contracts went through. And, of course, probably the most harebrained of all was the one that Weinberger and his merry men decided would be the best, namely the Dense Pack. And, of course, a handful of irreverent journalists quickly decided the Dense Pack was a marvelous label for the men in the American Pentagon. And if they didn't, they should have. My point, though, is that this kind of weapon is not only a serious threat to the survival of Soviet land-based missiles, and thus a threat to the survival of the Soviet Union, but inexorably is a threat to the North Americans who own and possess and deploy these weapons. Any weapon system that looks as if it has to go first because it's vulnerable and might go first because it's accurate is a weapon system that provides tremendous temptation to the other guys, first strikers, and in the Soviet Union and in the United States, and I'm embarrassed to say in Canada and England and France and Germany, There are lots of military analysts in and out of uniform who think this is the way to go. As a matter of fact, there was a conference here today, and one of the papers that was discussed is a paper by Colin Gray and another one of the American military analysts who are explaining how important it is to have weapons that not only deter a Soviet nuclear attack on North America, but to have weapons that will deter a wide range of Soviet behavior. And as a matter of fact, I once used the expression, for those of you who are the right generation, there used to be in North America a soap called Does. And the commercial said, does everything. And today there is in the Soviet Union and in the West a small but fairly powerful group wanting to develop nuclear capabilities that will do everything, from deterring a strategic attack on the homeland to making sure that the other guy doesn't sneeze at the wrong time on the Berlin Autobahn. And in between those kinds of objectives, what you get is a justification for building every conceivable weapon system that can be built. So the MX, then, is one of those weapon systems that represents a serious threat to the survival of North America as well as a threat to the survival of the Soviet Union. Another weapon system that has, I think, some of the same characteristics but worse is the Pershing II missile. Now, there's been a great deal of controversy in Canada about the testing of the American cruise missile in the Alberta testing grounds. And I've been very disappointed the way in which the Canadians have responded to this. Some have said, we've got to go ahead, we're loyal NATO allies, and some have said, we've got to do it because it's good for the local economy. And others have said, well, they can't, there's no other place to test it. And those who've been opposed, it seems to me, are not making the right argument. The right argument is not that the cruise missile shouldn't be tested in Canada. The right argument is that the cruise missile shouldn't be tested at all. Now, when it comes to the Pershing II, which is the other part of the combination of weapons that the NATO defense ministers have, let me put in quotation marks, temporarily agreed to deploy beginning at the end of 1983 in a number of countries in Western Europe, we're talking about something that is very, very dangerous. The Pershing is even more provocative and higher on the provocation to deterrent ratio than the MX, because in addition to being highly accurate, and in addition to being even more vulnerable than the MX, because it's within the range of Soviet fighter planes, it's within the range of Soviet short and intermediate range ballistic missiles, it has a third characteristic that makes it particularly dangerous, and that is a very short flying time and therefore a very compressed warning time. This essentially puts the Soviet air defenses in the position of having not to, they can no longer say, well, we can at least make sure that those crazy Americans have launched a nuclear attack on the Soviet Union. And they have time, 30 minutes or so in case of the ICBMs, somewhat less time in terms of some of the other nuclear forces that surround the Soviet Union. And don't forget, the Soviets have a long traditional obsession about being surrounded by hostile capitalist imperial forces. And the trouble, the poor Soviets today are not only surrounded by hostile capitalist imperial forces, but they're the only nation in the world that is almost totally surrounded by hostile communist forces. And this is something that we should pay close attention to. And people who say the Soviets continue to expand their influence and the Soviets are on the verge of global domination, how are they doing if almost every quadrant in which they look, they see regimes that are hostile, they see people that are disloyal, and they see in the intelligentsia utterly contemptuous of what the Soviet Union has come to stand for. The Soviet Union today, in many ways, is a pathetic giant, overarmed, underdisciplined, underdeveloped, in no position to really exercise influence in today's global society. And I regret to say that if things continue, it won't be long before the United States looks just as pathetic. Now, coming back to the Pershing, so you've got not only vulnerability and accuracy and destructiveness, but you've got very short response time, which essentially means that the Soviets would have very little choice but to go to something that's called launch on warning. Launch on warning is a state of affairs in which we essentially derogate the decision to launch nuclear weapons to people who are way down in the political and military hierarchy, or under certain circumstances. We derogate that decision to a set of optical scanners and data processors in which the human mind and the human conscience has already played whatever role it can play. And as you know, today's information processing technology is not something designed with a great many spiritual or ethical considerations in mind. So what I'm saying is that with the MX and with the cruise missile and with the Pershing ballistic missile, you've got two very good examples of weapons that are very high on the provocation to deterrence ratio. This leads me then to ask, well, what changes in military strategy do we need? What kinds of changes would permit us to buy some time, to reduce the dangers of today and the increased dangers of tomorrow, and give us an opportunity to begin dismantling the minefield that has now been carefully laid out and hardwired in almost the entire Northern Hemisphere? The first step, it seems to me, is to accept the Chinese proposal and the Russian proposal. Both of these major power adversaries of one another have advocated on many occasions that all of the nuclear powers should accept a no first use declaration. Now, this has been very controversial in strategic circles in the United States, and even more controversial, of course, in Western Europe. In my view, it should not be controversial at all. Now, many people say, well, it would be merely a declaratory statement and of no strategic or political significance. By itself, it would have, it seems to me, moderate significance. It's the first step. But a no first use declaration has to be accompanied by an honest, clear explanation of why the United States, and one would hope the Soviet Union, which have after all gone to weapon systems that are a mix of first and second strike forces, why we should now say this was a serious mistake. We renounce the use of our first strike capabilities. And here's why, and I think what I've been saying for the last 10 or 12 minutes should give you a rough idea of what such a statement to the Russian and American people, as well as the rest of the human race, would embrace. But the declaration and the explanation by themselves would not be enough. We then have to act on this declaration by, first of all, denying ourselves the deployment of first strike weapons that are in the pipeline, and then by phasing out first strike kinds of weapons that have already been deployed. More specifically, it means that in the West, we would say, this may sound very utopian of me, but the Scowcroft Commission, which is now examining the alternative options for basing the MX, does have within its mandate the power to recommend no deployment at all of the MX. I have written a memorandum to General Scowcroft, who is a reasonably close friend of mine, urging exactly that strategy. Now, I would be absolutely delighted if this was the recommendation that was brought in. It's certainly not what I expect. I expect that the recommendation will be, do not deploy it in any land-based mode. Put these in small coastal submarines. That would be my expectation on the basis of who are the people on the commission and the kinds of political, budgetary, and technological considerations that are dominant today. And while one could hardly cheer and say this is a great step toward the survival of the human race, it would indeed be a discernible and, it would seem to me, a plaudable small step in the right direction. The next weapon system, as you might guess, that the West should decide not to deploy is the Pershing II missile in Europe. Now, to get into the political, psychological, and military arguments around Pershing II would take us a full evening, and I won't go into that now, but if you want to get into a little bit during the discussion period later, I'd be delighted. The third weapon system that the Americans should decide not to deploy is, of course, the cruise missile, particularly the land-based or ground-launched cruise missile called, as you would imagine in Pentagon circles, GLICKMs. Now, what are you going to do with the Russians? You're going to lick them with GLICKMs. And you can't believe how much of this kind of stuff is used in conversation among allegedly rational, responsible, mature men in and out of uniform to whom we have entrusted our physical survival. So the GLICKM is a weapon system that the Western world and the Eastern world would be much better without. These, it seems to me, are the most critical of the weapon systems to nip in the bud. The fourth one that needs to be nipped in the bud is the Trident II. The Trident II, in many ways, and from some perspectives, is even a more dangerous and more provocative and more destabilizing weapon than the three I've mentioned because, and I don't agree with this reasoning, but I want to at least present it to you, because it will be just as accurate, this is the expectation, just as accurate as, let's say, the MX. And mind you, having spoken about accuracy, I don't want you to believe that I believe that you can put one of these things in a pickle barrel at 6,000 miles. The accuracy of these weapons has been, it seems to me, grossly exaggerated, but not so exaggerated that I would reject the argument that it could indeed wipe out a very large fraction of the Soviet land-based system, and as I pointed out, 70% of their deliverable warheads are in the land-based mode. The Trident II will be as accurate as, let's say, MX, will be firing from a closer range because it's submarine launched, and because it's vulnerable, which I consider, relatively invulnerable, inasmuch as the underwater detection problem still remains, basically unresolved. What we're talking about is a weapon that could be fired from close in, short warning time, and particularly if some of the new terminal guidance mechanisms are brought to fruition, the Trident II could turn out to be a fairly good first strike weapon. Well, I mention these four as candidates of Western weapon systems that should not be deployed on the grounds that they reduce and detract from the security not only of the Soviet Union, not only of Western Europe, but those of us who live on the North American continent. These are weapons that are much too high in their provocation to deterrent ratio. The next step, and mind you, what I'm talking about so far has nothing to do with formal negotiations with the Soviet Union. In my judgment, we have been gulled, we in the West have been gulled into believing that arms control and arms reduction and disarmament negotiations have been going on for 35 years. That is basically a patent falsehood. There indeed have been lots of negotiations, there's been lots of chit-chat, lots of technical reports, but neither the Soviets nor the Americans has in any consistent way made what I would consider to be a bona fide effort to put a cap on, no less to begin reversing, the strategic or tactical nuclear or conventional weapons stockpiles. And if you look at SALT I, you look at SALT II, you look at the START discussions that are now underway, you look at MBFR in the conventional force field, you do not see very much effort, and of course you see absolutely no progress in arms reduction. I don't think that we have time to wait for these kinds of minuets to unfold in which the bargaining is conducted by people who are basically hostile to the objectives of arms reduction and people who do not have the political clout to make stick any arms reductions that they might conceivably negotiate. It is time for the number one power in the world, with the guidance of its allies in North America and Europe, to take some unilateral initiatives that will immediately enhance their own security as well as the security of the human race. Once we get moving in the decisions, the political decisions not to deploy these four weapon systems and others, then the next move, of course, is to begin unilaterally phasing out the land-based systems that are now deployed in North America. The same reasoning that I applied to these other four weapon systems, in my view, applies to the Minuteman I and Minuteman II systems that are now deployed in North America. These weapons are no asset to American security. They are a menace to American security. They're a menace to Soviet security. Now, once these kinds of moves have occurred, you can easily imagine that either there has been a pretty radical change in the thinking of the political and foreign policy elites in the major powers, or there's been some kind of popular revolution. And I don't necessarily mean an armed revolution, but I mean that the rascals have been turned out in full force during a series of elections. And this, of course, gets me to the question of political tactics. That is, it's one thing for us to sit down in a fairly rational, calculating way and say, here are the moves that we think, on the basis of our analysis, on the basis of prior historical cases, on the basis of very careful consultation, would reduce the likelihood of World War III. And it's quite another thing to see those decisions put into place. Now, the reason I dwelt at some length earlier in my talk about the other factors that lead to the decision to acquire excessive military capability is here's where the political tactics become very critical. One of the first things we've got to do is make sure that the citizens of the world know that we don't arm for national security alone. We arm for a multiplicity of other reasons, and in a large sense, we arm because it's what we have come to do very well. In a large sense, we arm because those who are opposed have gradually lost their clout, their status, and their legitimacy. One of Singer's many laws says that with every billion you put into a weapon system, to some extent, you enhance the political and economic and psychological clout of those who want more, and to that extent, you reduce the clout and legitimacy of those who advocate less. And after nearly 40 years in the Soviet bloc and the American bloc of this virtually unbroken increase in the acquisition and deployment of strategic, tactical and conventional weapons, the political power of those who think we're overarmed is mighty weak and mighty small. If we're going to turn that around, we're going to have to enhance and expand and accelerate the acquisition of political, economic, and, if you will, psychological or moral or emotional influence. And I'd like to close by reiterating that this is not going to happen by playing politics as usual. And it's not going to happen if the peace movement behaves in the West as it has during the four or five prior occasions in the last 3.5 decades when you have seen a momentary and never effective resistance to excessive military preparedness. What the peace movement is going to need this time is a degree of sophistication, steadfastness, if you will, morality, tactical skill, hard information, and political savvy. We have never seen that in any peace movement in the history of the modern world. We may get it this time, and it is to people like those of you who have turned out tonight to discuss this issue that we have to turn. In many ways, it's in your hands. Thank you very much.
There will be a period during which you can ask questions. You direct them to the speaker. Perhaps you'd be good enough to repeat the question.
Oh, I'd be glad to, yes. And let me extend the judge's invitation, not only questions, but interventions. However, I hope they will be mercifully brief. And even though I have a constitutional difficulty of responding briefly, I will do my best so that we can cover a wide variety of questions. Yes, sir. Very nicely put. The question, of course, is what kind of deterrent makes any sense today? And particularly, listen, I want to say that was not Kissinger's PhD thesis. His PhD thesis would have been passed at the University of Michigan, but in history, not political science. I do accept the need for some kind of deterrent of a military sort, but only with reluctance and only because we are now in such a pretty pass that we've got to start where we are. And therefore, we have to find a deterrent that is as minimally provocative and maximally credible as we can get. And it seems to me that one of the few virtues of 20th century weapons technology is that it does make it possible to acquire and deploy and talk about certain kinds of very destructive weapons in a way that would make them relatively unprovocative and at the same time relatively credible. But you got to make sure you don't have too many of the wrong kind. Now, the Feldman dissertation that was, I think, done at Berkeley under Kenneth Waltz has this interesting notion, as I remember. Also, one of the points was that nuclear proliferation wouldn't be bad because the nuclear weapon is indeed the ultimate deterrent. And if every state had a nuclear weapon, then every potential rival of it would be deterred. And, of course, a number of people with PhDs have been making this rather bizarre statement of late. And it rests on the very charming notion that nuclear weapons will only be used as a consequence of careful, sober thought under conditions of leisurely contemplation. As I've already suggested, it is too late for that, ladies and gentlemen. The Northern Hemisphere is already hardwired. The decision makers are human beings and machines, all of whom together and in tandem have shown themselves to be very, very error-prone. Now, on the matter of reducing the, if you will, the defense perimeter and making it very clear and very unambiguous, we will let you guys do whatever you want outside of this area, but if you try to do anything within this area, you've had it. And I think that's just politically very, very naive. One of the points that has not been given sufficient attention in the discussion of military strategy is that we build military capacities not only to dissuade but to persuade. And as I've already indicated, this can be carried to some very dangerous extremes. But for a nation to defend its interests in this anarchistic international system, it's important that it use a wide variety of instruments in a wide variety of regions. And as a matter of fact, lest there be any doubt, I would like to see the Americans, the North Americans, challenge the Soviet bloc to what could be called protracted, non-military, non-clandestine conflict. I would like to see the Americans and their friends, and that does not include, obviously, the ultra-right-wing, highly autocratic, repressive regimes that we bring into our camp on the grounds that we need them in order to put a stop to the fascistic, oppressive regimes on the other side of the Oder-Neisse line. But what it does suggest is that we in the West still enjoy a multiplicity of advantages, industrial, technological, and economic. And believe it or not, despite all of the incredibly stupid and brutal political acts taken by or in the name of the free world, we still enjoy a kind of prestige and legitimacy that is absolutely remarkable. The Soviets lost that a long time ago. And there are just so many ways. If we stop thinking in terms of Fortress America, Fortress Israel, or what have you, and start thinking in terms of a global village in which there are people of a wide variety of interests, colors, religions, and so forth, and we begin asking, how can we shape that global village so that without jeopardizing the survival of all of us and without imposing our will, we end up with a society that is closer to our own values. And that's the sort of thing I'm advocating. Yes, some other questions. Yes, sir. Sir, I've heard this litany on many occasions in my career. I even spent a fair amount of time lecturing and consulting at the war colleges in the United States and in Western Europe and in Japan. And I have essentially two points. First of all, as I've already suggested, in terms of the overall strategic, tactical, and conventional balance, it would be a gross exaggeration to say that the Soviet Union enjoys a discernible advantage. As I said, in the Central European theater, the Soviets have more of some things and the West has more of other things. Now, on the strategic thing, the numbers are absolutely unambiguous. There is no way that a competent analyst of the strategic balance, and I'm pleased to say that at a conference in Ann Arbor 2 weeks ago, President Carter and President Ford were there, and by golly, Carter finally got up and said publicly what, if he had said publicly years ago, might have seriously slowed down the crazy round of nuclear weapons acquisition that we now face. He stood up there and he said, in terms of strategic nuclear capability, the United States has a clear, discernible, and unambiguous advantage over the Soviet Union. And if that guy had said that 4 years ago, you wouldn't be getting all of the nonsense we're getting today. I'm unhappy to say that Gerry Ford did not stand... I beg your pardon? In any event... The problem, though, is that Gerry Ford has still not publicly said what Carter said and which I've just said, and which all of the empirical evidence, top secret down to Time magazine, will show to be true. Now, the other litany, the Russians have this long list of aggressive behaviors. They indeed do. And name me one major power in the history of the modern international system that has a list any shorter. There is no major power. And let me add, because so much of the foolishness that has brought us to this pretty pass has been justified in terms of the fact that the Soviet Union is a highly repressive fascistic society. Anybody who wants to quarrel with that is crazy. The facts are there for us to see. This would be one hell of a place for intellectuals to live. This is a society that has done very badly by its own people. It has treated its own people in an excessively brutal way. Name another major power that, if it hasn't done that at home, has done it abroad. It is a widely known technique of all major powers through history. But even if there were a profound moral difference between the domestic politics of various major power foreign policy elites, that itself is no moral or pragmatic or intellectual justification for saying we've got to keep arming at this crazy pace until we blow the whole bloody thing up. I don't care how repressive the Soviets are. That does not provide any moral or pragmatic basis for continuing to acquire weapons that threaten our own survival. Ms. Knapp. Ms. Knapp.
Okay. Even outside of nuclear war, let us just assume we go on the way we are arming. At what point are we threatened internally because we are diverting too much of our resources to the military? And I'm not even worried about the Soviet Union. I'm talking about our side.
This is a very important point. Ms. Nimitz raises the question of to what extent do we jeopardize the domestic fabric of our own societies as we continue to pile up our military capabilities. Now, one of the troubles has been that we've had two schools of thought amongst economists and social scientists. Believe it or not, there has been a steady and fairly large element of social scientists in North America who have accepted the position that military expenditure has a more or less a direct positive linear relationship with domestic health. And even after Khrushchev told us that, look, I don't know where you guys get your Marxist ideas, but let me tell you, I'm a Marxist, and I think you Americans are making a very serious mistake because you are jeopardizing the sinews of the American capitalist economy by this terrible misallocation of resources. Now, of course, we didn't pay much attention to Khrushchev because we knew that he had ulterior motives and he was merely trying to get us to unilaterally disarm so the Russians could march all the way from Vancouver to Montreal. And I hope indeed he will take the northern route. Increasingly, though, there has been an awareness among scholars, journalists, and politicians and opinion makers to the point of view that you express, that military spending has been increasingly, and particularly beginning with the 1968-69 fiscal year budget in the United States, which is now, of course, 15 years ago, when it was decided by the Johnson administration and the congressional leadership to use a fight now, pay later strategy for the Vietnam War, which of course led to a very rapid bulge in the federal debt. And I belong rather unambiguously to the school of thought that says that military spending in today's capitalist economies or mixed economy is inflationary. It's inflationary because, this is a standard argument you learn in college, you're putting resources into the production of goods that have no social value and themselves cannot be purchased, and thus they don't feed back into economic growth. They're inflationary in a lot of other ways. You've all heard about cost overruns, and you've all heard about how virtually every modern weapon system ends up costing somewhere between 15 and a couple hundred percent more than was originally estimated. This isn't surprising, because when a contractor signs on to produce so many of such and such a weapon, there's usually a deadline. And these people have to tool up quickly. They've got to go after personnel. So how do you get personnel quickly? You bid up the price. You take them away from the consumer goods sector or light industry sector, and you bring them into the military sector. You also bid up the price of the finished, semi-finished, and raw goods that go into the production of military hardware. And because price is no object, you're willing again to bid up the goods. And the military contract in the American economy is a basic contradiction to free enterprise, because there's no longer competition in any meaningful sense. Another way that it's, of course, dangerous is not so much what it does to the domestic sinews in our own country. In order to make it efficient and economical to begin, let's say, a new production run on, let's say, the F-15, you want to make sure that the contract is for a large enough number of planes. And if it's decided that you don't need that many more for your own military forces, what you do is you send your peddlers out around the world to see whether you can sell them to the Chileans or the South Africans or the Israelis or somebody else. And as a result, the Russians and the Americans and the British, the French, the Czechs, the Swedes and the Israelis, to take, I think, the top nine, have exported in the last 15, 20 years so much in the way of weapons hardware that they have seriously affected, by my lights, economic development in the third world. And one of the elements that we have to worry about in terms of the overall Soviet-American struggle and the overall confrontation will be the rate at which economic development begins to take hold in the third world. And one of the things that has continued to be an asset to the Soviet Union has been the continued misery of people in the third world. And one thing that causes that, in my mind, without any hesitation, is the fact that an increasing number of third world nations are arming at a very excessive rate. So I think the issue you raise is a fundamental one, and you're absolutely on the right track. Yes, sir. Well, I think it's important to bear in mind that we tend, I think, often to exaggerate the extent to which it's an economic control and dominance. As I've already indicated, I'm worried because the incentives for going along and supporting and even applauding, joining the cheering section with the acquisition of every new weapon system, extends much more wide and much more deep. And it meets not only economic and material needs, it meets the psychic needs and organizational needs of many sectors and strata. I think that's going to be changed when the American people decide to get themselves informed, decide to take a closer and harder look at the kind of information that they've been getting. And it's not hard. In Canada and the United States, it is easy to be well-informed. We have indeed a free press. I don't want to say we have a competent press. I don't want to say we have an honest press, but we have a free press, which means that if you know where to look, you can become well-informed. And, of course, one of the most useful places to go is, of course, congressional hearings. The American system is still fantastically open. And if you want to really want know what the arguments are, don't rely on some journalist, some slick journalist, who sits on his backside in Washington or New York and discusses over a three-martini lunch what the latest wire service release tells you. Get somebody to start reading these things or read them yourselves. Matter of fact, if I might, I'd like to put in a plug. I.F. Stone is no longer in business in any regular way, but for some of you old-timers, you know that he, for many years, put out a weekly newspaper that was a magnificent piece of creative one-man journalism. There was a guy who did his homework. But somebody has come along that does a pretty good job replacing that, and this is Admiral Gene LaRuck and his merry men at the Center for Defense Information. They publish a monthly called the Defense Monitor, and as far as I'm concerned, it is a highly reliable, accurate, competent source of information on weapons technology and military strategy. Now, as far as the other aspects of the problem, all you've got to do is start reading more widely and more carefully and start doing reality testing by talking to your friends and your colleagues. Certainly, you can't rely on the New York Times or the Washington Post. And you certainly cannot rely on the magazines like U.S. News, Newsweek, or Time. Although about a month ago, the job they did on arms control, Now or Never, was remarkably competent in my judgment. I'm arguing that this is the first step. You gotta get informed so that when somebody starts to tell you about the way in which the Russians are heading this and the Chinese are heading that and the Russians have done all these things, you gotta have the data in front of you. But secondly, you've got to get organized. And you've got to begin using that organization to put pressure on political candidates. In the United States now, we've got some very promising choices. Sure, the journalists are telling us that Fritz Mondale and John Glenn and Hart are the front runners. Well, if the peace movement people sit casually back and say, well, this is a very interesting horse race, let's see who's going to come out on top, we've had it. As far as I'm concerned, none of these three people would be an acceptable nominee on the Democrat side. Now, for the moment, there's a candidate by the name of Alan Cranston. I don't know what kind of president he'd make, but that's not the issue now. He's the only avowed, announced candidate in the United States on the Democrat side who has said, we have gone too far. We are dangerously overarmed. We are destroying the American economy. We are standing in the way of global economic recovery. This excessive military spending is destroying any hope of economic development in the third and fourth world. We've got to find those kinds of political candidates, not only at the national level, at the provincial level, municipal level. We've got to make the question of survival the number one and most salient issue. And when people tell you at the provincial or municipal level, that's not our job, that's for people in Ottawa or Washington, tell them, wait a second. You may think that garbage collection is more important to our survival than avoiding the nuclear war problem. I don't agree with you. I would just as soon have my garbage picked up only every fifth day instead of every fourth day. I want you guys, you responsible for the welfare and security of the people in this town, I want you to start paying attention to that. Yes, you're right. You're next. All right, you go next.
Thank you.
Right. Well, of course, those are two separate issues. One is whether it's dangerous to test it in Canada now, or whether it's dangerous to test it any place later. And of course, my argument is that no matter what kinds of precautions are taken make it a relatively beneficent activity in the short run, it is a destabilizing weapon. I don't want to argue. First of all, you've got to differentiate, as the advocates have, as among sea-launched, air-launched, and ground-launched cruise missiles. And what we're talking about here is basically the ground-launched version, the GLICM. And I have no hesitation in saying that the ground-launched cruise missile belongs at the high end of the provocation to deterrence ratio weapon systems, because it is a highly vulnerable weapon when it's in place, and because it's highly accurate as it moves toward its target. And some would say it's also a destabilizing weapon because interception against it is so difficult. I'm less certain about that. I think we've exaggerated that. But it is a weapon system that adds nothing to the deterrent capabilities of the Western forces, and I would even go so far as to say anything that increases the numbers of deliverable nuclear warheads at this stage is by itself provocative and destabilizing, even if it were not a relatively vulnerable weapon when it's in place and a relatively accurate and destructive weapon when it arrives on its target. I might also add one more consideration that makes the cruise missile a particularly unattractive weapon is that because of its relatively small size, it is more easily concealed than a number of other weapon systems. And if we ever do go to Soviet-American East-West negotiated arms reduction, in which inspection becomes fairly critical, and I see that as a second or third stage, then it would be very much better for all hands if the smaller and more easily concealed weapons had not yet been deployed. Yes, Wallace, you had a point.
Just a follow-up on the cruise question. The point is often made in Ottawa, I think commonly by the Prime Minister, that the cruise is a fairly defensive weapon because it's slow.
Mm-hmm.
It's inconceivable, and it's still quite definitely related to those slow missiles. What would be the answer?
Yeah, well, yeah. The question is because the ground-launched cruise missile moves at a relatively slow speed, it's distinctly a subsonic weapon, that it therefore can't be used for first strike purposes. Well, that's silly. The speed is not the important thing. The question is whether or not the weapon could indeed be launched at any time, moving even at subsonic rate, if indeed it is as undetectable as its advocates allege, in due course it arrives in the vicinity of its target, and then the detection and interception forces have a very short warning period, and that's what matters. It's the time between detection and arrival. Now, in my own view, the one reason I'm not very, even if I were an ultra hawk, I wouldn't be very enthusiastic about the ground-launched cruise missile, because not only because it is very vulnerable in place, but my own guess is that the launching will itself be a highly detectable event, and therefore the tracking and the interception will not be too hard. So, and even if the launching were visible and detectable through a wide variety of surveillance technologies, and the interception and tracking were not, its mere launching would be a provocative and destabilizing event. Yes, sir, you've been trying to get a point.
Yes, I've been worried about this for some time. In view of the fact that the Russians are known to be avid deviants, real time to do things in the QT, and of course real time to do the same thing. But they seem to be determined to talk to the world and all this, so they don't really seem to leave everybody alone and let us get about our own business. What's to stop a power like that to put atomic bombs, which are which can be detonated by remote control at some future time, into the various major harbors like Vancouver and Seattle and so on, and at some predetermined date, set them off by remote control? And have you any defenses against that sort of devious attack, which would be undetected? Some Russian team or some team here, we don't have any inspectors that would locate this sort of thing.
This is a very important question. The hypothesis is made that a devious power like the USSR, or I might say, or the Chinese, or the French, or the Cubans, or the PLO, or a radical faction of any of the more respectable or unrespectable political parties in the world, could quite easily, I think what you're describing is a physical possibility, put nuclear weapons in ships, buses, trucks, airplanes, all kinds of vans, and either detonate them at a predetermined time, doing a tremendous amount of damage, or somewhat more credibly, announcing, let's say, announcing to the Americans that we now have a sufficiently large and destructive number of nuclear warheads clandestinely placed in every major industrial center in your country. We would like you to pull all of your troops out of Western Europe. What is to prevent the Soviets from doing that? And my answer is, not a hell of a lot. I think it would not be that hard to do, and with each passing year, it becomes easier. Just remember the frequency with which there has been this great hullabaloo when somebody announces how he would go about constructing a nuclear warhead and using a combination of fission and fusion, detonation, and explosive devices. Somebody recently, a very competent nuclear physicist, made the crack. I think he was serious, and it seems plausible to me. He said, think how long it would take four or five bright high school kids to build an automobile from the ground up. Yeah, a couple of weeks. He said those same bright high school kids could build an atomic warhead in a couple of days with the same amount, basically the same level of engineering sophistication. We, ladies and gentlemen, this is not a science fiction problem. It is a real problem that exists today. I'm glad you raised it. Yes, sir. I'm glad this came up. The question is, well, are there people on the Soviet side who are advocating a more prudent and rational and intelligent kind of military strategy? The answer is yes, but they're very few. And there are a number of people in this room who, like myself, have had fairly frequent contact with our Soviet counterparts. I don't want to say they're a neat bunch of guys, and I certainly don't want to say that the sort of fellows with whom I'd enjoy having dinner every night. I wouldn't even want them to be training my students or educating my children. We have a lot of very fundamental differences. But they are bright, competent people in their own way, and they are as politically prudent as their American counterparts. And you can easily imagine that the man who delivered this particular statement here tonight is not exactly in excellent odor with the American defense establishment. As a matter of fact, it's been more than a dozen years since I've had a security clearance, and it's been a long time since I have been asked to work on any major projects for the Pentagon. And so, well, I don't want you to think that I'm a man of such excessive principle that I don't do this as a matter of principle. I would be delighted to do it if it would increase the opportunity for this point of view to make its way felt. Now, on the Soviet side, and this comes back to my use of the phrase political tactics, we now have a relatively new regime in the Kremlin. And like every new regime in recent Russian history, this crowd has been brought in as reformists, because every Soviet regime in modern history has been incompetent, and disastrously so. Can the Andropov regime pull off the kinds of reforms that some people would want, and that many people in the Soviet Union would want? The answer is probably not without a lot of help from their American friends. In the wings today in the Soviet Union are lots of little potential Stalins. The Soviet system is basically in the hands of a fluctuating, fluid coalition in which you have heavy industry, which you have the military, particularly the army. As a matter of fact, Khrushchev probably met his demise because he was unsuccessful in his clever ploy of trying to play off the Soviet rocket and missile forces against the army. And, you know, he gave them the Cuban adventure, which was supposed to make them happy. It didn't work out exactly as the scenario would have it. And they failed to blow up the world, although they tried damn hard. And as a result of this and other things, Khrushchev was out. So you've got these various elements of the Soviet armed forces. You then have the light industry consumer goods element in the coalition. And then, most tragically, you have what is often referred to as the provincial rural apparatchik. And these are still basically the most powerful people in the Soviet Union. These people do not want reform. The only way these people are going to be weakened in the Soviet system, according to my model, is for Andropov to be able to show progress in terms of economic reform and economic growth, and in terms of meeting consumer needs within the Soviet system, and that, of course, includes agricultural productivity. He is not going to be able to make those gains if he has to continue trying to match the Americans in the strategic and conventional arms race. In my view, the Americans could do a lot to make Andropov. I don't want to say he's a closet liberal. He's not. And I don't care what his ideology is. What I care about, what are the raw facts of political and military and economic power in the Soviet Union? How can we, through our political processes, and how can we, through the shrewd and honest and skilled use of our political tactics, create a situation in which the reformers in the Soviet Union at least get a couple of years to try to modify the distribution of power? One way we can guarantee that Andropov will go, either he will go the way of Malenkov in 1954, or he will go the way of Brezhnev, which is start out as a reformer and end up as a captive and a spokesman for the right-wing reactionary apparatchik. The Americans and their Western allies have, it seems to me, a pretty interesting chance to turn things a little bit around in the Soviet Union. If we go ahead with the arms that are now on the drawing board, and if we go ahead with the arms that are in the pipeline, you can bet your bottom dollar that this will be yet another Russian or Soviet regime that is as fascistic, oppressive, and incompetent as all of its predecessors. Okay, yes. Why don't you, yes. Young lady, here you. Excellent. Yeah. The question is, we've identified some of the American weapon systems that are particularly provocative and destabilizing. Are there not Soviet weapon systems that are equally provocative and destabilizing? and whose abolition we would like to see occur. And I think the answers are fairly obvious to those of you who have studied this subject closely. Certainly, the most important thing is for the Soviets to begin phasing out the SS-20 for two reasons. Not only because of its objective military characteristics, a relatively accurate, high-yield, vulnerable weapon, close into NATO air defenses, and therefore close in and vulnerable to a NATO airstrike as well as a missile strike, but also because the SS-20 has been, if you will, the boogaboo. It has been that weapon system that has provided the raison d'etre in the United States, and particularly called the FOBS, the Fractional Orbiting Ballistic System. If indeed the Soviets are planning to go ahead to test and deploy essentially a fourth type of strategic weapon system, i.e. a satellite orbiting, not ground launched, not air launched, not sea launched, but space launched. If they go ahead with that, I can only say they will have done more than their share to bring on the ultimate nuclear holocaust. So that would be another thing the Soviets can do. My more general point is that we in the West are so far ahead in terms of what really matters. And even if we were far behind, it would not matter in terms of national security. We should be taking the initiatives. We should be urging the Soviets to come along every step of the way. But if we say we're not going to do it until they do it, if we say that somehow or other we don't want to reduce the threat to our own survival until they reduce the threat to their own survival, then we will end up being just as culpable as they. Let me end up then by reiterating a couple of points. We are dangerously and tragically overarmed, with consequences not only to the social fabric and the economic prosperity of ourselves and the rest of the world. We are dangerously overarmed in terms of the prospects for the human race in the Northern Hemisphere to survive. Having said that, I'm saying that we don't need just to throw up our hands in despair. I'm not giving you the Jonathan Schell, come on. What I'm trying to say is that my reason and close analysis, and that of many of my colleagues and friends, is that there is still a chance to break out of this thing before it's too late. I don't think the chances are very good. But unless there is a very dramatic change in the way in which we approach intellectually, emotionally, morally, this question, until we break out of the tendency to deny and repress, until we break out of this idiotic notion that says, those guys know what they're doing. I can assure you, those guys know what they're doing only in a bureaucratic sense. They do not know what they're doing in terms of national security. It is time for the people of the world to take political power into their hands and tell these people that enough is enough, and the sooner the better. Thank you very much.
Ladies and gentlemen, to express our gratitude to Dr. Singer, I'd call on Professor Russell.
It's my very great pleasure to thank Professor Singer for this evening's talk. You have shown us how to approach in a rational way a problem that's complex and emotional and difficult, and I think we have learned a great deal from this. I'd also like to express my appreciation to you and to Kathleen for visiting the university this week as a Cecil H. and Ida Green visiting professor. Through your visit, you've enriched our academic life this week, and we appreciate it very much. You see, we weren't risking very much. As you said before, you had been here last year, and our members knew about you. They knew what you were going to say. We couldn't deceive them in any way. They came to see you. I think this says far more than I can how much we appreciate your visit.